Tonight, we're going to move on. And this is study 85 in our study of walk. And we went through, we went through 160 of the walks. Now, some of them we didn't cover, but quite a lot of them we did. And so this is study 85 on our study of walk. And tonight's study is 85, as I said, and this is the 11th day of May, 2016. And so we've been in this study for a good long period of time. But I think we went over a tremendous amount of stuff to grasp and understand. And so I've got a little introduction here to Ezekiel 1. We're going to go to Ezekiel 1. And to find out that along with what the Lord was giving to Jeremiah, he started giving to Ezekiel, to those that had already been carried captive into the land of Babylon. And so they kind of run concurrent for a period of time. And the structure in the book in the front of the book of Ezekiel will kind of point that out. But let me read you what I've written here and then we'll get involved. It says, as we leave Jeremiah and go on to the next prophet, Ezekiel, having looked fleetingly at the descriptive plan of Jehovah's dealings with his chosen nation, Israel, and their failures concerning his will. So, you know, as we went through, it didn't take long in Jeremiah to realize that all of the people were out of his will. But yet, he didn't forget them. And we realize that he used other nations of the then world to allow them to carry away those that God had chosen and to scatter them and to allow Zion to become desolate for a period of 70 years. And so he wasn't short with that, because that came out of the mouth of Jeremiah pretty straightforward. He said at that point he would recall a new generation and rebuild Zion, Jeremiah foretold by the words of Jehovah, all of this and also the hope of a return back to Zion. You know, the last three studies is maybe part of four studies is been that hope of a return back and to rebuild and to start the rebuilding process that must be done there, because God had declared that when they went back, you know, he wanted the temple area restored again. And so he set it up to where they would learn trades and do all this. And even if the old people didn't make it back, the younger people would come back with the skills necessary to do that with. And so, you know, Jeremiah was telling, was sending letters there, but, you know, he was sending out the word by letter to where the other 10 tribes would also begin to get wind of some of this stuff. And so we find that Ezekiel is a continuation, is in the, you know, continuation of Israel's captivity. And the table that we're going to look at here in the front of Ezekiel, on the start of the book on page 1105, if you have a companion Bible, I certainly hope all of you do. And it gives us the outlines and the dates as to when the prophecies were uttered And we realize, you know, that some were uttered before the fall of Jerusalem, and some were at the fall of Jerusalem, and some were after the fall of Jerusalem. And so that's the reason I asked you to go back to 1105 in the very first part of Ezekiel, or the what the Companion Bible has put in there is concerning the structure of the book of Ezekiel as a whole. And I also wrote that as we start in Ezekiel, Jehovah gives us a glimpse of the desolation in Zion and to the need for prophets to bring those in Babylon up to understand that they have not truly been forsaken, and give them future knowledge of what he was expecting. Okay. So with that said, we're going to look at the book of the prophet Ezekiel, and then we're going to just take a minute of the structure of the book as a whole that you find on page 1104, and realize that the desolation part of this book is going to be from chapter 1-1 to chapter 12-28, which I think that's the end of the chapter 12. And then it talks about the prophets and prophetesses, the men and the women, dealing with 13. And then in 14 is D, it deals with the elders. And then it talks on now 14, 15, the land and the city and the judgments that they went through. And F is going to be looked, Jerusalem is going to be looked at as a deserted infant, like someone left a baby on the doorstep. Everything's going to have to be taken care of. Okay. And then you got your Babylonian war. It's still in progress. And it says that the people in the proverb of the sour grapes, and you know we went over some of that. And Jeremiah talked about the sour grapes and putting the teeth on edge. The reason why, and he hasn't forgotten that yet. He talks about also the Prince of Israel. And then it goes back up to C again on the extended alternation, and it talks about the elders, the land, the city, Jerusalem, the Babylonian war, the people's side, and the inhabitants of the waste. Then it goes back to B and A. It goes again in reverse order, talking about the shepherds and the flock and the restoration. So the book ends up with the restoration of Israel there in Zion with Jerusalem and the whole area, Ophel and the other parts of the Mount Moriah area there, as far as that goes. And so, it gives you a list of references there in the appendixes, up there, but let's go down to where it says the canonical order of Ezekiel's prophecy is logical and not strictly chronological. Later utterances and visions are recorded in their logical connections rather than in the historic sequence. This latter is noted so that we may make no mistake. When this fact is observed and the record discriminated, the meaning becomes perfectly clear. And you got this table below here that it talks about. And it says there are 13 in number, the dating years in Ezekiel, 13 in number, and cover a period of 21 years. This is a period of 3/7, from 484, 483 to 463 or 2. So, you know, like some of these things you can't really break down to a real specific time, but a general time, you know, is what we're looking at. Arranged chronologically, the seventh stands in the center with six on either side. Reckoning the three in the 11th year as 1 year and three in the 12th year as 1 year, we have nine several years. The 5th, 6th, 7th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th is 7. And then after a break of 13 years, we have 2, which is the 25th and the 27th. And then you got the prophecies broke down. It said all these prophecies were uttered before the fall of Jerusalem. And you can see the years of captivity of Jehoiachin. And then you've got the month, which is their fourth month. You're looking at the Jewish month date, and then it gives our date in parentheses. And then the day is important, too, because the day is not the day of the week. It's the day of the month. Always that way in Ezekiel. It don't change. And then it gives you the chapter, and it also gives you the year date. Okay. And, you know, the 484 B.C., and Christ was born in 4 B.C., so, you know, that's 480 years, and then he started his ministry 30 years after that. So we're talking about what we're going to talk about this morning happened in 520 years before Christ came, started his ministry. Not before he came, but before he started his ministry. So, you know, these things are the little tidbits that help you go along in understanding. Also, under the table there, it says the 30th year of 1-1-2 cannot be in succession to the 27th year of chapter 29, verses 17 through 21, because the visions of chapter 1 and 10 have already been seen. And the one recorded in chapter 10 is said to have been similar to that already seen in chapter 1. Moreover, if it be in succession with the 27th year, why is it brought into the very beginning of the book without any reason being assigned or hint given? That is a question. And again, whoever wrote this, you know, put the question mark at the end of that. Well, you know, the 30th year, then, if you're going to pull that in, we got to go back. So the second little paragraph says this: the 30th year of 1-1 cannot have anything to do with Ezekiel's age or with the commencement of his service as a priest. For this is to misread Numbers chapter 4, verse 3, which state that all that enter into the host to do the work in the tabernacle were taken after the end of the 29th year, from 30 years old and upward, even unto 50 years. So there was a period of time there, if you were to do a service in the temple, you would have to be 30 years old and under 50 years of age. Because in the Jewish law, you know, you remember they looked at a man being under his father and mother until he was 30 years old. That's the reason that Christ waited until he was 30 years old to start his ministry. Oh, he knew at the age 12, you know, that he could take on just about anything. But nevertheless, you know, Joseph and Mary would be held accountable. He says, moreover, the 30 years rule was abrogated by divine direction to David in 1 Chronicles 23:24-27. And it was changed to 20 years old and upward. The 30th year cannot be fitted into any sequence of dates commencing with the 5th year of Jehoiachin's captivity, chapter 1, verse 2, which in 33, 21, and 41, he speaks of it as our captivity. Now listen to this. It must therefore be a cross date to some unnamed terminus, a quote. 30 years before the 5th year of captivity, this fixes it as being the epoch-making year of 513 B.C., which was the year of Josiah's great Passover and of the finding of the Book of the Law in the 18th year of King Josiah. From 513 to 484 is exactly 29 complete years. So also reckons the learned Prideaux in a book of McCall's something written in 1845. And it says, no month is named, but by comparing 30-20, it must be the first month. And then where it says 2 there in the table, no month is named, but it was probably the same as in verse 1. So, you know, when you look at these tables, and it talks about the day, the 5th, the 12th, the 10th, the 5th, 12th, 1st, 7th, all that, that's the days of the month, not the days of the week. So, having said all that, turn the page.
That's it. I always love the introductions in the CV.
Yeah, and they hold a wealth of information that makes it easier for us to understand as we go along. And buddy, we're going to need it. Because I'm going to do at least the first chapter and a little bit of the second chapter, and then we may skip a little bit. But here is the call to Ezekiel and what Ezekiel's seen when God chose to reveal something to him to begin with. He laid a load on him. Now, there's no doubt about that. It says, now it came to pass, Ezekiel 1:1, now it came to pass in the 13th year, in the 4th month, and in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Chebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. Okay. Now, the first verse starts with now, and you get down there and you find that and there where he says, I saw visions of God. Now and. So this is the link to the prophetic chain. If you went to 1 Peter 1, 10 and 12 and looked at it in 2 Peter 1, 21, it will give you a great amount of information that we're not going to go and look at tonight. That is your homework if you want homework. But it says, now it came to pass in the 13th year. This is the 484 B.C., that in the 4th month, and that was Tammuz, or July, in the 5th day, or the 5th day of July, of the month, and there, and it's the month and not of the week, as we said, as I was among the captives by the river of Chebar. Okay, this was Ezekiel's living place. This was where he was staying. But now, he evidently wasn't really captive because he was able to move around some. So, I don't know by him, he may have been considered by Nebuchadnezzar a priest of God when God was dealing with Nebuchadnezzar to begin with. I don't know, but it was pretty evident that he was able to move around a little bit, because in chapter 3, you find this river Chebar again, and it's not the same place. It's the same river, but it's not the same place. It's not his home. He has been told by God to go there. Okay? So it was kind of like Jeremiah when he was told to get this linen ephod and put it on and walk down to the Euphrates, and he'd show him where to go and hide the ephod. And so it said, it came to pass in the 13th year, 4th month, 5th day, I was among the captives. It didn't say he was a captive. He said he was among the captives. This was his home, his living place. Okay? And I want to read you the note on that, but I want to read just a little bit of the note up there where it says Ezekiel right across in verse 1. You know, in the Hebrew, it comes in two or three different forms. And you got the Y-Hezel, or the Yehezekiel, and it says E-L is strong, and it means to be strong or to be strengthened. And it says of the four greater prophets, Ezekiel and Daniel, and they were the ones that prophesied in Babylonia, in the place of Nebuchadnezzar. They are compounded with the E-L on the end of their name. Appendix 4 with number 4. While Isaiah and Jeremiah, who prophesied in the land, are compounded with Jah, or basically A-H is the way it's generally pronounced on the end of the end of the names. It says Ezekiel was a priest. 1:3, carried away 11 years before the destruction of the city and the temple. And it gives you the 1:2, the 33:21, and 2 Kings 24:14. He dwelt in his own house, 8:1. In Jeremiah 29:3, he was married, and his wife died the year when the siege of Jerusalem began. So when Nebuchadnezzar went there and carried away a lot of the people out of the area, was about the time that his wife had passed away. And so I think he had not done very much in the terms of doing anything until he got this revelation here that, but now he doesn't have a wife, so he doesn't have anything to hold him back. You know, with Jeremiah started prophesying when he was 13, so I don't know if he ever got a wife or not, but be that as it may. Okay, we're not getting very far now to see that. But he said the river Chebar, and Chebar is now Kahabar, and it says probably the same as Chebar or Habor. On the inscription, it is called Mar Kibori, meaning great river or grand canal cut between the Tigris and the Euphrates. So it doesn't tell us in the notes here how the canal was cut between the two rivers, whether it was done by an act of God or whether it was done by an act of man. But evidently they needed the extra water for whatever reason. And so somewhere back up there, they made a canal made. It says in chapter 3:15, it's not the same Chebar as in verse 1:1, but the Chebar to which Ezekiel was sent. Where it says, go get thee, 3:4, the Chebar of 1:1 was where he dwelt. That of 3:15 was that where he was sent. So, it gives you that information, and quite a lot of information, but if you're going to get into this book in any depth, you need all of it. So it said that the heavens were opened, verse 1, and I saw visions of God. Verse 2, in the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, this was when it was. So it gives you, kind of gives you that information over again. And also, it was 6 years before that that you find in Jeremiah 32. Turn back with me, keep your finger there, and turn back there with me to the, you know, we finished up with Jeremiah 31 last time. But I want to read you just a little bit in 32 here as to what happened. And this was 6 years on down the road a little bit. And so Jeremiah 32:1 says, the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord in the 10th year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, which was the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. For then the king of Babylon's army besieged Jerusalem, and Jeremiah the prophet was shut up in the court of the prison which was in the king of Judah's house. For Zedekiah, king of Judah, had shut him up, saying, wherefore dost thou prophesy and say, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will give this city into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall take it. And you see, Zedekiah was playing right into God's plan anyway. And Zedekiah, king of Judah, shall not escape out of the hand of the Chaldeans, but shall surely be delivered into the hands of the king of Babylon, and shall speak with him mouth to mouth, and his eyes shall behold his eyes. So you see, you got a 5 or 6 years different. It's right there that you can count in the time period of all this thing in verse 2. Then we get to verse 3. The word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar, and the hand of the Lord was there upon him. So, it talks about the word of the Lord, and this again is Jehovah as it was in most cases with Jeremiah. He says, the word of the Lord came expressly. You know, where do we find that in Hebrews? Speaks expressly.
Expressly.
With the exact words?
To Peter, I think.
Okay, and Peter, okay. But when you look it up there, it is in reality unto Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi. As Jeremiah and Ezekiel were called, they too, the office of prophet as well. So not only when they were called because of a priestly line, but also they were to prophesy in their respective places. And Jeremiah in the land of the Chaldeans and Babylon is where Ezekiel was by the river, again, Chebar. And the hand of the Lord, and that hand there is the expression anthropopathia, and it means giving to God what God gives to man. God give man a hand. It doesn't say that God has to have a hand. God is spirit, true spirit, doesn't need a hand. He can speak whatever he needs to speak into being, okay? But he said the hand of the Lord was there, or became upon him. So there was no doubt to Ezekiel where this was coming from, and so he began to understand why that he was chosen for the job that he now has. And he says, and I looked. So he's going to start telling you about what he saw in when the heavens opened. He said, and I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire, enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Oh, gee, we got a lot, again, to look at. And he says, and I looked, or as I looked, and behold, when I beheld, this is what I saw. This is the subject here. He says, I looked and behold, this is what I saw. So he's going to give us a description as best he can of something that he's never seen before.
Yeah.
You might say not having been written about very much either. So a whirlwind, okay? A whirlwind, a ruach, a spirit came out of the north. Guess why? It came out of the north. The north, that was the seat that Satan wanted to have in the sides of the north. This is the throne area of God, evidently. Okay? I don't think that would be really too far to stretch this thing out. And it's rendered whirlwind or storm. And we might call it a tornado. I don't know if they have tornadoes over there, but it's hard to say. But it comes down to a great cloud and a fire. And so there's a note in the CB about, on four, about the great cloud and the fire. It says, note the three symbols of Jehovah's glory. A storm, cloud, and fire. He talks about that in, I don't know where I could pronounce that enough, but also in Revelations 4:5. And it talks about it coming out of the north. And not only that, but it continues on. It says, enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it. So it acted like it was taking hold of itself. And it was flashing continually. And so, when you look at a tornadic wind or a big storm like that, it carries with it this high voltage situation that does a lot of damage, or can do a lot of damage within itself. And it says, and out of the midst thereof, that's 8432 in the Strong's, and that is the word tavek. So it means a bisection or the center of the what's going on there. there as the color of amber. And amber there is 2830. And the word there, I think, is kashermal. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what it seems like it would be. And it says that's the color of amber, and that's what amber is. And if you look it up in the Strong, it talks about polished bronze or glowing metal, as in as if you were looking at a blast furnace. You know, if you work in a steel mill and they use a blast furnace to get all this thing going and get the slag out of it and everything, and finally the pour comes, you know, and it comes with a pretty as pure molten metal as they can get. But a blast furnace would give you the amber color glowing metal. Now, there's other furnaces that man has devised to come up with that I suppose they didn't have in those days. When I worked at Fairfield Manufacturing here in Westminster, and it's the same Fairfield that's on Lafayette, Indiana. They call it something else now. They don't call it Fairfield anymore. But they put in, when they come down here, they put in an atmospheric furnace to heat treat the gears and the many different parts that went into some of these hydraulically driven torque hubs. And that atmospheric furnace had a bunch of different compounds of gases that were fed into that booger, and it had a double vestibule in it. And when you went to put a piece in there, the door came down and closed it into the outer vestibule, and then they purged the air out of it. Because if you just opened the doors up right quick, you had a problem.
It's going to be bad. Yeah.
And it was going to be a bad day. And Tommy Finley worked that thing, and I don't know how we all survived. But needless to say, he didn't make the mistake. But anyway, when you looked in the little peepholes in that thing when it was working properly, and you looked in the peephole, it was such a beautiful pink haze in there, completely. The whole interior of the furnace, and it was about a 32 by 50 building, like a house built on a cement floor with all kinds of stuff on it to keep it from cement from popping up. But it was just so beautiful, and it just almost made you want to go in there, you know, but you knew you couldn't go.
Yeah.
And on the other end, they had a double vestibule, and when they opened it and they would bring the part to the outer vestibule, then they would close it back down so it couldn't get air, and then they would let that out into a stack that went up outside the plant. But you know, this was what was needed for the gears and the other things that were put in there. It was a very brilliant pink. It was so beautiful I can't really describe it hardly, but it was beautiful. And then another situation that we have here with the fire, and we're going to deal with this fire because it is with these things that we're going to talk about here. And you have fire from God. And you remember when the cherubims were placed at the ends of the Garden of Eden. And it was to guard the way of the tree. And so it stated there that it had fire within itself, within these beings. It was riding on the wheels. But, you know, down through the years, we have had what we call in the fire service SHC. And that's spontaneous human combustion. And I've never seen it in my time, but I've seen pictures of things where people have laid down and were ashes. They become ashes. Or even laying in a bed and they became ashes and the bed didn't burn. And so, you know, I kind of look at that as being fire from God because He can destroy things and truly destroy it. Now, we can change the structure of things a lot, but we can't really do away with it. But God can do away with that. So, that's a situation where it burns only that that God chooses to destroy in that sense. And so, as we look at this fire, we realize that truly, we went through a lot of this scripture, and we've talked a little bit about strange fire, and we've also talked about fire from God. So, we have to really make that kind of discernment as we look at this, because these things are under God's control. This cherubim, if you will, is under the control, I think, of the Holy Spirit, to that sense. So he says, I looked and beheld a whirlwind come out of the north, a great cloud, and the fire enfolding itself, and the brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof is the color of amber, and out of the midst of the fire. Also, it says in verse 5, and out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. So from verse 5 to verse 22 gives you a description of what these living creatures look like as far as Ezekiel could get it. And it says this was their appearance, and they had the likeness of a man. Okay, break that down. So out of the storm center appeared images of living creatures found on earth, and these creatures are still living today. We have man. I thought I could call him right off. And let's see, 10. The face of a man, the face of a lion on the right side, the face of an ox, and all four had the face of an eagle. So they had four faces. It's like if you could visualize a head, or this is the way I kind of visualize it, they broke it down into four sections, and each part of the face area would be a section of four different faces. Now that situation, okay. And they represented the things that were living on the earth. You can find the man, the lion, the ox, and the eagle. And they all represent something, you know. And he says, and this was their appearance, or this is what I saw. They had the likeness of a man. And in verse 6 it says, And everyone had four faces. And everyone had four wings. So it gives you a little bigger description of the fours there. And it said in verse 7, and their feet were straight feet, and the soles of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. Okay. So if you go back and look at 6, and it says everyone had four faces, and everyone had four wings. So these four things that were represented there in this one vehicle, if you will, they seem to be a private representation, but they all seem to work in unison, because it says in 7, and their feet were straight feet or unjointed. And it also gives you the understanding that they didn't move by walking. They never walk. But boy, can they get around. And it said, and the soles of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot. And the calf's foot there is 5695 in the Strong's. And it is agile. That's the way it's pronounced, agile. Like, you know, if you say somebody is agile, you mean they can get around well, okay? But they've got feet, but the feet's not really used for walking. So, still, the word comes out agile. A round pad, if you will. Because the calf's foot, if you look at it in the, where it makes a foot in the ground, is a calf growing up, it is almost the perfect circle. Those two pads, because it's a cloven hoof, but the two pads together makes almost the perfect circle in that sense, okay? And it says, and they sparkle like the color of burnished brass, okay? That's 7044 in the Strong's, and it means kolal. Kolal in the Hebrew. And it means polished brass. But wait a minute. Brass is something not found in the earth by itself. Brass is a combination of an alloy. It is more than one different kind of metal. It is, maybe it could be, several different kinds of metal. So, here we go with this polished brass. So, brass is a mixture of metals when heated up. Now, a lot of times they'll let it cool at different temperatures. And it'll give you a different hue in the same piece, the sheet, in the same sheet of brass. It won't look exactly the same as the other part of that sheet of brass. If you went to buy a sheet, you know, it may have two or three different looks in it. And that's because of the way it's cooled off or whatever. Even if it is polished. So, that kind of gives you the implementation of a color of a rainbow a little bit. Because if you look at a rainbow, it will start with a primary color and blend down to something else. And this is the way brass will do if it's not cool.
I remember seeing that when you used to braze up radiators, you could see all the colors in the bead that you'd put on.
Yeah, it would. As long as it was warm or hot, it would have different colors to it because it was gathering... It was gathering the junk from all that and making it work, putting it back in. Okay, so we said that brass was a mixture of metals, and that's a a freebie. I won't charge you nothing for that.
Isn't it weird that he's describing a creature, but the description makes it sound like a machine?
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Basically, it is.
Very mechanical.
Yeah. It
even
is.
Even down to the polished metal look of the thing.
Yeah. And we'll go to verse 9 and we'll quit. Because, you know, we're not going to get down near to the end of this chapter. And it says, their wings were joined one to another, verse 9. They turned not when they went, and they went every one straight forward. So wherever they went, they didn't move. It was like if you got in a pair of shoes on a board or a piece of metal, and there were four pairs of shoes there, and these four individuals were standing on that thing, there was something under it that turned them, and they always went face first. They always went toward where they got, but they went like lightning. See? And that's something that we don't know anything much about. Well, you know, when you get down here and you look in the structure of this thing, it says from 1:1 to 1:26, the cherubim first vision. Well, it don't say anything in Scripture about calling them cherubims. But when you get to chapter 3, and it talks about the hand that he saw. He says, in most versions of the original versions, it wasn't plural. It wasn't hands. It was hand. Because I believe it was in chapter 3 or chapter 8, it talks about hand. That there was one that stuck a hand in to get this fire of God out.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, so if it's in one, it ought to be the other the same way. But I can't agree with that, really. Because, you know, you can cup your hand and you can't hold much. But, you know, if you put two together,
you do pretty good, yeah.
You can get a pretty good amount out of that hand. So it says they went everyone straight forward. So here again, whatever this thing, however it's fixed, and it'll tell you about how it works, it can travel at a great rate of speed and back, like lightning, it says. Okay, I don't know how fast lightning can travel. I've never heard them really say, but boom, you know, it's done and gone.
Speed of light.
And okay, speed light. Okay. So that being said, you know, these can move at that rate and back at that same rate of speed. To do the will of the Spirit, it says. And it says the Spirit is in the wheels. Now, or directing the wheels. It doesn't really have to be in the wheels, but the Spirit of God can direct these things because it, when you go to Appendix 41, and we haven't been there yet, but we need to go there first thing next time and look at it and read that whole Appendix 41. Oh, that's another study thing that everybody can do is to look at Appendix 41 and take it with a grain of salt, because that is one that I don't wholly agree with because of the way it's presented there. Because I think, and I know that this is something that God uses in Him keeping the earth the way it is. And it's not a cherub. Now, the cherubim is plural. It means, you know, they four. They four in this group. And, you know, they were carved out, put on the back of the mercy seat and the Holy of Holies, you know, where the the wings
overshadowed
and crossed. And these still have the wings, and they're still, when they raise their wings, all of them are crossed, but they've still got, they've got two wings that goes up and two wings that goes down. And so I'm not sure that Ezekiel, he might have could have seen one hand, but I don't know from where he was whether he could have seen if they had another hand or not. And so that's one of my little pet peeves with the with a descriptive thing here that you know, and I know they have a reason for doing that, but I guess it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. The hand, I don't know, has some implication in all this. But yet, I haven't gone far enough to really understand what it is. But we see in 9 that the wings were jointed one to another. They turned not where they went, and they went every one straight forward. So everywhere they went, they could turn. And the wheels, when the wheels, when they were lifted up, the wheels were lifted up. So all this was a one-unit thing. And it was, the very bottom part of it was certainly kind of mechanical in terms of understanding, my understanding anyway.
And I've seen several artists' renditions of this thing from the description.
And it is...
Interesting, yeah.
It is something else.
Very interesting.
And, but... You know, and all of it, you know, it had within the bottom part of it, it had the, evidently had the fire of God in it. So, I don't know what, you know, great situation that was, but nevertheless, it carried within it fire. And it, some of it acted like a lamp, and a lot of times as it moved, it kind of went up and down like it was a, like it was clearing away or something. But everywhere it talks about it going is a straight line. It doesn't talk about going around the curve or anything. It would turn like a, it's kind of like a honeybee, you know, leaving a, leaving where it's getting, gathering honey and going back to the hive, they call it a beeline. It, you know, when he leaves, his direction is placed within him, and that's where he goes. And that's the way it is. But, you know, it tells all this for a reason. And so we need to realize in Ezekiel that, It gives a lot of this stuff on down the line, so I felt like it was worth going over to begin to see it. So, as the old saying goes, tune in next time, and we'll see if we can give you a little more of it. But that ought to be enough to kind of whet your appetite a little bit. But it certainly does me, because, you know, having dealt with a little of this stuff for just about all my life, it really gets my mind going and as to how things work. And I've always said that man couldn't figure out a car if he didn't know God. Because, you know, with a car, I kind of look at the engine as being the power plant, which it is. The engine is the power plant, and it's what gives it the oomph to go, and the transmission is like the Son of God. It gives the direction. And it gives you where, you know, which way you go and how fast or how slow you go. It's controlled by the gearing in the transmission. And that's the sun's part. And then I believe that the differential is the Holy Spirit, because you never go around the curve with a locked rear end, you know, because one wheel would have to catch up all the time. And so you have a differential there that takes up the difference and keeps you from having to go in a straight line. That's like a wagon, you know, or a buggy. In the buggy days, in the wagon days, they had a hard axle across, but the wheels turned on the axle. And so it wouldn't matter if one was turning faster than the other. But when you get into a vehicle that's made out of metal, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And you have to have something to make up the difference. And so you have the gear in the gear, within the gear. Yeah. Same thing with the watch. We can never learn to keep time on our wrist without understanding that we could make gears to where we could make that watch keep an exact second or close to an exact second. So think about those two things a little bit, and God bless you.
Pray, pop quiz next week.
Pray for us that we get things straightened out and get them going a little better. And gee, if it wasn't for something like this, it'd really make the day long. So love you all. God bless you.